In the mosaic of the world's many cultures, the Buddhistic culture of Tibet has a unique role to play. In his lecture, part of the Distinguished Speaker Series at SUNY New Paltz, Robert Thurman will be talking about Tibetan culture as world treasure, what it is, how it came to be, what are its gifts today. The lecture takes place on Monday, November 4th. Thurman is a professor of Tibetan Buddhist Studies in the Department of Religion at Columbia University and serves as president of the American Institute of Buddhist Studies. He is also co-founder and president of the Tibet House in New York City. His latest project is a new book he is the co-author of, Love Your Enemies, How to Break the Anger Habit and Be a Whole Lot Happier. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Thurman back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. You're my favorite station.
Well, thank you very much. I always enjoy spending time with you and talking to you. This is a fascinating lecture of Tibetan culture as world treasure. When you think of it as a world treasure, how can we all take part in that treasure?
Right. Okay. Good question. Well, the thing is, it goes along with a wonderful exhibit that they have down there at SUNY New Paltz, and they've been having it for a little while, and this lecture goes with that. And it's a little bit remote for people at first to think of Tibetan Buddhist culture as a world treasure, but then we have to reflect on ancient India. And ancient India was, it's where yoga came from. You know, on a more earthy level, it's where the Kama Sutra came from. It's where the Shakespeare of ancient Indian Sanskrit came from, a playwright named Kalidasa, who Goethe said was the greatest playwright humanity had ever seen, all this kind of thing. So India had a really golden age in the first 1,000 years of the common era, millennium. And the central part of that were these great Buddhist universities in North India, or North, all over India, actually. And they developed an amazing library of what you could call the mind sciences, the sciences of emotion, 1,000 years or 1,500 years before the neurosciences. They developed this amazing culture, psychology, and so on, how to, like, shape human life from the inside out, you know, from the heart out, from the mind out. And then what happened was, about 1,000 years ago, India was overrun first by a lot of people from Central Asia, and then from Persia, who didn't want those universities, and they kind of knocked them out. And then by the Europeans, and actually the British rediscovered the ruins of those universities. So the libraries were all burnt and destroyed by all this 1,000 years of invasions. And then, however, luckily, in the last 500 years, from 500 Common Era to 1,000 Common Era, the Tibetans translated those libraries and took the curriculum of those universities up into Tibet, and they polished them and refined them and meditated on them and cherished them for 1,000 years. And like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who everybody likes so much, he's kind of a product of that curriculum and that library. The other day down in New York, he was giving some lectures, and he said, what I have to say is backed up by 300 volumes in which there are 5,000 Indian works translated into Tibetan, and then there are many thousands of Tibetan works based on that. So I always like to say, as an analogy for American people, it's like if Indiana Jones fell in a hole in Ethiopia and discovered a perfect Ethiopian translations of the content of the Library of Alexandria that was burned in the 4th century by some religious fanatics. If he discovered that, then what kind of a treasure would we see that in our Mediterranean, you know, Euro-American sort of cultural stream? And so the Indian stream, the equivalent of that in the Indian stream, is their libraries of Alexandria were destroyed, and then they are now found in Tibet. They've been brought out by the Dalai Lama, by the exile community, and they are now, we're slowly translating them into modern languages, English, Chinese, French, German, etc., and they are becoming known to everyone. And it's just very, very helpful to the world to have this, like 10,000 Freuds, you know, 5,000 Carl Jungs, suddenly available to us. Because India, even Bertrand Russell and great English philosophers like that, they concede that India was the greatest psychological, philosophy and sort of scientific way of managing, you know, yoga and bringing your not only yoga of the body, but yoga of the emotions, yoga of the unconscious. All that was brought out thousands of years earlier. So that's sort of my spiel in a nutshell.
And as you point out, there are the gifts and this wonderful and rich history for over thousands of years. And we look at what Buddhism contributes to the world today, but also what more it can contribute in the future.
Exactly. And the big thing about it, which the Dalai Lama was emphasizing, when people think Buddhism, you know, they think, oh, that's religion. Well, we already have ours. Or some people who are secular say, well, we don't like any religion. And they have their reasons, and I don't blame any of them. But the main thing that is coming here is not just some sort of new religion thing like Buddhism is going to save everybody, because what people don't realize is that Buddhism is a whole civilization. It has sciences and arts and all kinds of things that are not just having to do with religious belief. And so, and really what the greatest gift is the sciences of Buddhism, which can help, that were wound up with Buddhism, rather, from those Buddhist universities, which can help people who are spiritual or even people who are spiritual in the secular humanist way. It can help them realize that and live their own spiritual philosophy very well. In other words, the Dalai Lama always makes a big fuss about how he's not trying to convert anybody. He doesn't want anybody to be Buddhist. They should stay with grandmother's religion or grandmother's no religion so grandmother doesn't get upset. But it can learn stuff about how their mind works from the Buddhist civilization, you know. And that's really what it is. For example, you know, when we say it's gifts for us today, this takes me to the topic of the book that Sharon Salzberg and I wrote, I Love Your Enemies, and many books that other people are writing, where Love Your Enemies, of course, is a famous statement of Jesus's, right, in the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
And it's a famous statement of Buddha's some centuries earlier in India, in his equivalent of various sermons on the Mount, various mountains, different mountains, which is that hatred will never put an end to hatred, and violence will never put an end to violence. You have to love the hating person. You have to be patient with them. You have to be nonviolent with the violent, gentle with the violent person. And yet, in our modern psychology, we think, and maybe even traditionally in the West, we think, well, that's great for Jesus, and that's great for some saints, but no thank you, I don't like my enemy, I'm not going to love him, sorry. You know, he hurt me, and I'm afraid he's going to hurt me again, and I'm not going to love him. And our psychology tells us it's unrealistic, that spiritual statement. It's admirable, but unrealistic. Now, the Buddhist psychology says, actually, it's realistic. And it explains it that, you know, if you loving means wanting a person to be happy, your beloved, when you love somebody in a true altruistic way, you know, true love, you just care that they are happy. You don't, it's not possessive, you know, you don't want to get a hold, grab them or manipulate them. You just want them to be happy. And so if your enemy is happy, why is he going to bother to harm you and run around and chase you? What a boring thing to do. He's going to enjoy being happy. So wanting the enemy to be happy is actually practical. They won't invade you. They won't kill you. They won't even bother with you because they'll be so happy, you know. And so in that sense, it has like a practical side to it. And furthermore, like remember Martin Luther King, when he was beaten up down there in Alabama, and then his friend said, come on, Martin, you can't love those people. You got to like be angry with them. He says, no. You know, it doesn't mean I want them to beat me up, but anger and bitterness is too much to bear. It's too heavy a burden. I do love them, even though they're behaving badly. I don't love the way they're behaving, but I love them, and eventually that nonviolent love will make its point to them. He had that faith, and he did succeed, actually, in the civil rights, although he had to pay for because there's always some lunatic who shot him. But basically, the South, there's a lot of tolerant people in the South who he woke up by being loving and nonviolent, you know. So there's a place where, you know, Sharon and I are drawing on the Buddhist psychology, the Buddhist knowledge of meditation, the Buddhist way of dealing with the unconscious, and being more happy by not nursing anger. Even though you might be forceful with people, you might be strong with them, but you're not gonna carry around. You're not going to insult yourself on top of being injured by your enemy by carrying hatred and bitterness around in your heart.
Robert Thurman is our guest this morning. The name of his lecture at SUNY New Paltz on November 4th is Tibetan Culture as World Treasure. He is also co-author of the new book, Love Your Enemies, How to Break the Anger Habit and Be a Whole Lot Happier. And I want to stick with that subtitle for a moment in regards to just what you were talking about, because really it's up to both sides to break that anger habit, that the anger that we have outward and the anger that is coming toward us.
Right, exactly. But the thing is, we can't necessarily change the anger of the other person. And especially if we are angry back and we beat on them, then they feel more justified in being angry and beating on us. So, but what we can do is change our own heart and not react, not be reactive and not be hair trigger and not then even get to where we're afraid of somebody and then we even preemptively attack them when they didn't do anything to us. All of those reflexes that go along with habitual anger. And the neuroscientists actually nowadays agree 100% with the ancient Buddhist psychologists in that they say that nursing anger and hatred, it makes you sick. It actually spoils your heart fiber. It'll give you heart attack, high blood pressure. It ruins your circulatory system. Your adrenal glands pump out cortisol, and you get really, like, really bad digestion. You get ulcers. So it's actually really bad for your health yourself. And now the key thing, Joe, that people, you know, when they think about, well, why not be angry with my enemy? They think that anger is going to help them defend themselves, because anger is sort of what we call in Buddhist psychology an addictive emotion. Mm. It gives you a little bit of a rush and makes you feel temporarily stronger. But also what it does is it lessens your good judgment. It makes you overreact. It makes you hurt yourself even, you know, carelessly and recklessly. And while it might clear somebody out of your way for a little while, they'll come back at you even stronger, or their friends will. And so it never improves the situation. It leads to a vicious circle. So the key thing that this will surprise people, because they think, oh, if I'm not supposed to be angry, then I just have to be trampled on. I just have to be a doormat. And actually, the key thing is no. The king is like be like a martial art, you know, be like grasshopper, you know, like a kung fu guy, and stay cool and be forceful without being angry, and be forceful, therefore, with the best of judgment, with real precision, and just do what it needs, what it takes to defend yourself or evade that person. Try to up-level the enemy's anger by cracking a joke if they're not shooting actively. If they are, duck. You know, but in other words, you do something very strong, but without hatred and anger, so it will be really on target. And like any martial artist will tell you, if you lose your cool, you'll get off balance and the other opponent will throw you. If you stay cool and forceful, then you'll throw the angry opponent. And that's the essence of the martial arts. And so this is relates to that. You know, this is very similar, you know.
I'm curious as to why, though, for many of us, that the default and the way that we seem to be hardwired, maybe more so now than in the past, is that the default is to become angry. And as you think, what I love the word that you use of it being a habit, that we become angry instead of the default being love and understanding and ultimately happiness.
Right, right. Well, you're absolutely right. Although I don't agree that I do follow Dalai Lama, who's so optimistic. I mean, he's in my mind today because he was just in New York for a few days, and it was such a delight to see him talk about a treasure. He is a treasure. But anyway, people maybe are, I think, are less angry. I think we are a little bit propagandized in our culture because, after all, what is our major industry probably in this country is quote unquote defense, which, you know, we have a bigger defense budget than the next 30 countries combined or something like that. And, you know, we're very frightened of this and that person, and we're in an endless war on terror and all of that. And we have been ever since we won the Second World War, which was perhaps the last good war. And so we are therefore conditioned to think that it's necessary to be angry and we should be scared all the time. Actually, we are much more, we have neuroscience telling us it's really bad for your health. We are very informed. We know, we really know other points of view. We're much more highly informed than anybody has ever been in history. We know that in appalling conditions that people live in refugee camps or in the, who are the victims of wars and thereby produce people who are so filled with hatred that they do nasty things like terrorism. And they're so, you know, because their whole town and city was bombed crazily, you know, and they have, and then they go to the fanatical side of their whatever their ideology is. And so we're kind of conditioned to think that it's right to have this reactive, angry thing. You know, in school, we played football, lacrosse, hockey. I was played hockey and lacrosse, bashed people over the head with sticks. And we are conditioned to do that. But actually, look at that. We've been sitting here with nuclear weapons for 70 years, 65 years, and we haven't used them. And there hasn't been a world war for these years. There's been these little things, which are kind of really bad for the people in those places. But there has been a kind of restraint at the macro level, and there remains a restraint. And we have some sensible leaders who don't just blast off a few missiles just to look good to people who say that's what you have to do, and who instead, like, talk about it and try to negotiate and do this. You know, Dalai Lama argues that, you know, we have to, the 21st century has to be a century of nonviolence and dialogue, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't remain defensively strong, but the fact that aggressive war has actually shown itself to be unproductive already in the first decade of this century. We didn't really get anywhere with it, and nobody won, you know. And Afghanistan broke Russia. It's wasted a lot of our money. Iraq and Afghanistan wasted a lot of our money, and they're still fighting there. It hasn't really pacified any of them. So, and Vietnam was like that, but we know it takes time for this to sink in because we're driven by an establishment that for which war is a huge business, you know, really big one. So anyway, I think that it's a bad habit that we have, and then particularly there's another thing, Joe, and that is that we guys are more socialized to be a little bit quicker to anger and more aggressive, and we think that's sort of manhood and machohood. And our girlfriends are conditioned to be more polite and more gentle, and then they tend to feel a little bit annoyed that we push them around, kind of. We don't listen to them, and we do this and that. I'm not saying you, Joe, and I hope not me. It's now, in my older age, we have to ask my wife to double check. But I think I'm better than I was when I straight out of, you know, Harvard or something. But after a little Buddhist training, you know. But the thing is, so they think that if they don't show anger, they're going to be trampled by men, and they won't be able to sort of make it in a macho world. But actually, no, they can be forceful without being angry, and they can be more skillful at doing that. And we can take a lesson from them, actually, how to do that and how to be forceful without raising the voice and gesturing harshly and speaking harshly and going ballistic, you know, what we call going ballistic. And I think it's not that difficult to learn not to be reactive, and boy, are people happier. And are they happier with us when we don't have a knockdown, drag-out argument with our uncle who's of a different political persuasion and spoil a good Thanksgiving dinner that the ladies made? Mm. You know what I mean? Everybody's happier, you know, when we don't have that kind of family squabble, you know, at the dinner table. And if we learn to be more restraining of our gut reactions, then we can do that, and we can hear the other person's point of view. And look at our Congress. My goodness, they're like crippling the country because they can't talk to each other, you know. And so then we might think, oh, well, they're just hardwired like that. But actually, of course they can learn to talk to each other. Mm. They talk to their fellow colleagues, they talk to their wives, or they wouldn't have any, you know. They talk to their children, I hope. So therefore, you know, we have to overcome the stereotype that we're all mad as hell and freaking out, and therefore excuse those people who do behave reactively and who we could say are addicted to anger, and try to help them be a little happier and healthier before they have that heart attack.
And the point that you make in the book, which I think is so important, is what we get out of that. I mean, it's not just breaking that cycle, but also that what we get out of it is that we as a people and we individually are a lot happier.
Exactly, exactly. Like, you know, like Gandhi got rid of the British, you know, by nonviolent method. He had been violent. There were other Indian leaders who espoused violence and tried to, you know, do a little shooting here and there, drop a bomb here and there, and they gave the British all the more excuse to clamp down viciously on top of them. And they would never have gotten loose except the nonviolent pressure of Gandhi and getting the moral high ground and even reaching out to the English population, seeing what the military and the colonial authorities were doing to the Indians. He liberated a whole country like that, and Martin Luther King led to the civil rights movement by nonviolence, whereas the Black Panthers ended up in jail. So actually, nonviolence is a very... There's a wonderful scholar at Harvard called Gene Sharp. He's retired now, and he wrote many books on nonviolence as a civil defense method and all kind. And even in the World War, there were different nonviolent movements in Eastern Europe where they saved a lot of people from the gulags, you know, from death camps. They saved people sometimes by nonviolent methods, you know. And not always, but sometimes. And so it's a very powerful thing to remain nonviolent. And as you know, as we all know, like, who's the coolest when there's a family row? The person who stays coolest is the one with the high ground in the family row. The ones who are shouting and sulking and slamming doors, they have to come around with, "I'm sorry," later. Right? And right. The cool one is cool, you know.
Well, Dr. Rob...
the ladies.
Well, Dr. Robert Thurman will be the distinguished speaker at SUNY New Paltz on Monday, November 4th. The name of the lecture, "Tibetan Culture as World Treasure, What It Is, How It Came to Be, What Are Its Gifts Today?" You can find out more information about the lecture on November 4th at 7:30 by going to newpaltz.edu, newpaltz.edu. Dr. Thurman is also the co-author of the new book, "Love Your Enemies, How to Break the Anger Habit and Be a Whole Lot Happier," which is published by Hay House. Robert, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. I enjoy the time we spend together.
It's a great pleasure. I always enjoy it too, Joe. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And all the best to you and your colleagues there at WAMC.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you. Again, Dr. Thurman will be speaking at SUNY New Paltz on Monday, November 4th at 7:30. You can find out more at newpaltz.edu. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.